Good afternoon. How's everybody doing today? Welcome to NHC in Grand Rapids. My name's Ron Price. I'm your AHA Governing Committee representative. I'm here to introduce to you a gentleman that has epitomized the everything to do with brewing, all the way from the Bay Area in Napa, California. Colin Kaminsky is going to do a talk on conditioning and aging beer. He frequents radio show programs like the Brewing Network and another local area program that he hosts. He started his career as a product designer for Moore Beer. He's designed more than 180 products with those folks. He's been the master brewer at Downtown Joe's since 2003. I know that he knows his way around water pretty well. He's the co-author of the Water Book with along with John Palmer, it's called A Comprehensive Guide for Brewers. In fact, he was just doing a book signing, as you can see up over here. He's also won the Beer Writers Guild Award for Best Feature Article. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Colin Kaminsky.
Well, welcome to Grand Rapids. My family's from Michigan, so it's kind of fun to come back here. Last time I was here, I was 8 years old. My great-grandfather moved to Detroit in 1906 and met my great-grandmother in 1906 at a Polish mixer. And they'd grown up 20 miles away from each other in Poland and came to Detroit to meet, and that's where my family came from. So it's kind of fun to be back in Michigan and remember all the old family stories. My grandfather passed many years ago now, so the Polish side of my family is pretty much gone. There's nobody left that speaks Polish anymore in my family, but it's good to be back out here. This talk that I want to do today. Everybody was like, "Well, why don't you come out and talk about water?" And you know, we just got the book out. Not everybody's read it. Once people have read the book, the questions about water are going to become a lot more interesting. Right now, everybody wants to ask me the questions that are answered in the book. So I thought I'd go back to an article I wrote 15 years ago and update it and rewrite it and kind of reintroduce it. We, as brewers, we kind of think, well, you know, once we transfer out of the boil kettle, all we can do is throw yeast in and hope for the best. Well, it turns out there's lots of things that we can do. I have 18 seven-barrel aging tanks at Downtown Joe's. Allows me to do easy 30 days brew to serve. I do no filtration whatsoever. I've done more than 1,000 batches of beer as the master brewer. So for me, what happens in the aging cellar, not only do I have a lot of time to make corrections, but I have a lot of desire to make sure that by the time that beer gets out to the faucet, it's in the best condition I can get it. So this is going to cover some of the things that I've learned over the years. My goals in the aging cellar, I want to settle out for clarity. I find that filters do good things and bad things. The good thing they do is they get your beer through the system faster. The bad things is diatomaceous earth, DE filters, tend to add iron, and we'll talk about why iron's really bad in beer. But if you aren't going to use a filter, then it's going to take time. You're going to use gravity as your filter. So I'm a proponent of the gravity filtration method. I think it does less damage to the hops, and I think it does less damage to the beer than filtration methods. Now, there's ways of speeding that up called fining, and we'll talk a lot about fining here today. Another thing I want to do in aging is I want all those short-chain proteins to link together into longer chains. I'm going to talk about a lot of organic chemistry systems here as black boxes because we don't really care which ones they are as brewers. Analytical chemists do. But as a brewer, I need to know if this went wrong, what black box was likely the problem. If I need to open that black box at that point, I have a textbook that'll get me there. So I like to generalize in the beginning And then when you find a problem, then dig through that black box. So one of the black boxes we're going to have today are proteins. We're going to assume that there's long-chain proteins and short-chain proteins. And we're going to assume that there's head-negative proteins and head-positive proteins. And without getting into the details of why it is that those things are turn out to be true. The other thing I want to do in the aging cellar, the main reason why I want to link the proteins together is to maintain head retention. The other, does that one work? Awesome. I'm going to leave it right here. Okay. Thank you very much. So, one of those buttons. There, okay, I got it. The other thing, head retention is just absolutely beautiful in the glass. This pint of beer here, I think, is a great example of what I'm looking for in head retention. I can get that without any problems if I have 30 days of aging. I don't always have 30 days of aging. So trying to do things better so that that comes together naturally in the aging tank is really important to me. We'll talk about choices I make in the brew house to do that. Most important thing you can do during aging is your yeast is done with the beer. Do not harm your beer. You're the biggest risk factor to your beer there is. I've had all sorts of random problems where perfectly good tank of beer got destroyed after it should have been money in the bank. And so we'll talk about things like that. The first place that aging starts turns out to be the brew house. If you make a mistake in the brew house, you can't fix some of them in aging. Some mistakes in the brew house you can. If you accidentally forget a bag of malt, you can brew another batch of beer that's got two bags of that malt and blend them back together in aging, and you can fix that problem. But if you have iron in your water or other things, you cannot fix that at that point on. So first thing I want to talk about is my other black box in this lecture. It's a family of molecules we're going to call reductones. Reductones mean they want to grab oxygen molecules. There's all sorts of organic molecules and inorganic molecules in beer that want to grab onto oxygen molecules. The cool thing about reductones is they protect your beer from oxidation. The really bad thing about them is those oxygen molecules are only temporarily bound. So at some point during the shelf life of that beer, they are going to let them go. And you can be guaranteed that that oxygen will get back into your beer. So keeping oxygen out at every stage is really important so that the reductones are fresh when you get to into aging. They're able to attack any oxygen problems that you might have post-fermentation. And that you're not using that whole buffer system so that during storage, those oxygen molecules don't get re-released to make staling issues. Far as head retention goes in the brew house, malt-derived polyphenols cause hazes. They cause hazes that can be confused with protein hazes. I try to keep them out of the beer so that I don't have to do aggressive fining, which strips out some of my head retention. So the main places I find malt-derived polyphenols in our brew house, there's a picture of our brew house actually, is from overheating the mash, over-sparging by running your water either too hot during sparge or trying to over-extract sugars, over-milling, grinding the grain too fine, or transferring the grain to the boil. Now, I considered putting a little image here of a grain kernel to show you the parts of the grain kernel that make the worst flavors in boil, but that can also be a black box for us. Just assume that if you're transferring any particulates, whether it be husks or AccuSpire, over into the boil kettle, it will create an off flavor in the beer that also cannot be fixed during aging. Proteins, you can settle out some of your proteins, and it turns out settling proteins out in the brew house is a good thing. We can convert them, which is would be a whole other lecture on mashing theory or malting theory, but you can also settle them out. I do long, slow Vorloffs, and I can leave a lot of protein in the mash tun. The German word for the fine silt of protein on the top of a mash is called Teig, and I look at the end of the mash every day and try to get a good feel. Did I get as much Teig as I normally get? What did I do right or wrong this time? I'm doing about 110, 120 batches a year. So that gives me a lot of day-to-day experience of what do I look at, what do I see. And I find that to be a really important check. In the boil, we coagulate proteins, and this is where you read about foam chemistry, where a lot of that stuff comes about. If you read Charlie Bamforth's papers on foam, a lot of what he's talking about is going on here in the boil kettle. And I like to settle out as much protein as I can. I used to skim the boil kettle every day. I would still like to do that. Unfortunately, the way the process works right now, skimming the boil kettle is very difficult for me. I skim the boil kettle because of long-chain fatty acids that I can remove right before boil that are harder to separate out later. I do notice a difference in head retention and the time it takes to get to head retention by not skimming. Protein coagulation in the boil, if you have your boil pH at the proper pH, now the first question I'm going to get is what's the proper pH, but I'm not going to answer it. If you have your protein coagulation pH set right, what will happen is you'll get these huge flakes of confetti in the boil, and they drop that boil out crystal clear during 15 minutes of whirlpool. And all of a sudden you look in there, and it's not all that fine silt of protein. All those big flakes fell to the bottom. When you hit your water chemistry right, get your mash pH right, get your boil pH right, make sure you have enough calcium in boil, that happens every batch. It's a phenomenal way of improving the time that a gravity-conditioned beer can come to life. However, it turns out that every batch of beer, every batch of base malt, and every recipe of beer, you want a slightly different pH to really make that all happen. So I can't answer the what is the right pH. The question becomes, what's the right pH for you? You have to do that by trial and error. I haven't found a good way of calculating it. In the boil, we also get hop-derived polyphenols. They also make a haze in the beer. To me, they taste like tea. If I get a pint of beer that's hazy, I can pretty quickly tell you whether it's a protein haze, a polyphenol haze from hops, a polyphenol haze from mash, or if it is a yeast haze, simply by flavor. And the only reason I can tell the flavor differences is because it takes different findings to get those out. And when you run one finding through thinking it's one thing and it didn't clear the beer and the taste is still there, that logs into your brain. So it's another experience thing. You try different things, and you start to figure out, oh, well, this tastes just like a polyphenol haze. And that's been a very valuable skill as master brewer for me. Cold break. I don't like the way the definition of the word cold break has worked in literature, and I don't know where the deviation is in literature. When I started brewing, we called cold break what settled out in the fermenter before the yeast started to go active. There's another definition of cold break, and that's what's at the bottom of the boil while you're transferring out. They're both one and the same, really. When George Fix was alive, he and I had a long conversation about getting the best cold break you can. And he and I talked about something that's been in place at Budweiser for a really long time that made a lot of sense to both of us. He actually built a system to do it. What he did was he would go out of the boil kettle into a 5-gallon Cornelius keg that was in a bath of iced salt water. He would chill it down to about 30 degrees and let it settle for about a half an hour and then rack off of it. At that point, you have no troub left. All of that troub is racked into that, out of that keg. You have nothing mixed in with your yeast. When you harvest yeast out of batches like that, there's no non-yeast solids. There's hardly anything. It is the cleanest fermentations I've ever seen. His beers were phenomenal. There's no way I can introduce that to my brew house. But big breweries have big heat exchange systems that they can not lose all that heat and all that cooling ability. And can afford to cool it all the way down and then warm it back up to pitching temp. I can't. Getting that cold breakout is really important. You have to do the best you can. Bleeding a little bit off the bottom of fermentation before it's active can also be beneficial if your fermenters are designed to accommodate that. Cooling and oxygenation. You can see it's a 26-year-old heat exchanger, and it hasn't been painted in 26 years. That's in use every day at the brewery. It's hooked up in a cooling loop right now. And one of the main reasons why I try to get the Trub out in the boil and not get it into the fermenter is adding oxygen to Trub makes really, really nasty flavors. The process is actually called saponification. It's the process that makes soap. And don't really need any extra soap in my beer, thank you. So I do shut off the oxygen stone before I'm all the way transferred out of the boil kettle. So just in case any Trub from the bottom of the kettle moves through, I can cut that out. Yeast separating your yeast at the end of fermentation by cold crashing, takes a lot of load out of your aging cellar, which is really nice. It also, takes load out of, your filtration if you're going to filter. A lot of breweries fine in the fermenter. Finding in the fermenter is a relatively difficult process. Unless you're 5 gallons, and you can shake something up and let it resettle again. For me, it's much easier to transfer out of the fermenter, pull as much yeast off as I can, then transfer out. One of the big things that's going to damage your beer in aging and in shelf life is oxygen pickup. Post-fermentation oxygen pickup is even more scary than hot side aeration pickup. And I kind of skipped over hot side aeration. I'll go back to that at the end. When you're transferring is your most likely time. If you don't purge a vessel you're transferring into, the head space is in contact with that oxygen. That might not be so bad if you're not expecting a lot of shelf life, or if the beer's never going to get warm. Otherwise, I find pressurizing aging tanks to 28 psi 3 times and venting is an appropriate amount of oxygen reduction. I'll let the chemists out there do the math. I think when I did the math 14 years ago, I reduced the oxygen to 8% of what was in the tank to begin with. But I haven't done that math in 14 years, so I could be remembering that number wrong. Dead legs are a big problem in breweries. Anytime you have a T with a cap on the end, you try to transfer finished beer through it. That T not only is a source of biological contamination, but that T is also a source of oxygen pickup. You can store a lot of oxygen in even a short dead leg. Eliminating dead legs from your system at any point where there's finished beer is really important. Flushing kegs and bottles needs to be flushed like an aging tank. I've seen some novel bottle flushing methods. I think filling CO2 from the bottom is probably the best we're going to do until we get into multi-million dollar bottling lines. Fining is something that I am very proud of being very gifted at. Maybe it's the thing I understand the best in the brew house is to pull a sample of beer and fine it and get it to work. The reason why I know anything about it at all is 15 years ago I was at an hour-long lecture where Ian Ward gave me all the basics and told me exactly what was going on, told me about Stokes' Law, told me how and why it worked, and then spent the next 4 years working with me as my fining supplier, making sure that I was happy every day. He's now the president, I believe his title now is president of the North America's division of Brewers Supply Group. And back when I started brewing, he was just my local sales guy who I could had a PhD in chemistry, and I could sit down and talk to about brewing for as long as I wanted. It was a different time back then. Now I probably couldn't get him to return my phone calls. last time I talked to him, we were in an airport. Great story. Sitting there in an airport, and he walks by, and he says, "Oh, man, I got bumped from my flight. I've got 2.5 hours. What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just exhausted from the conference." He said, "I am too. I just need to settle down. Well, I'm going to go have a drink." And he disappeared through this unmarked door in the Seattle airport. And next time I saw him, I said, "What was that unmarked door you disappeared?" "Oh, that's the United Airlines Frequent Flyer Miles private bar for CEOs. Some unmarked private bar in the middle of the Seattle airport. Who would have thought?" So I use Imhoff cones a lot. I use them at all parts of the brewery. This isn't something that most people are familiar with unless they work in a chem lab. I've had a lot of questions about my Imhoff cones over the years. Lagunitas taught me how to use them. Ian Ward told me it was possible. Lagunitas taught me how to use them. And they're very interesting. You know, the fill height that you see in this picture, I stole this picture out of a catalog, by the way. The fill height on this is 1 liter. So you take a 1 liter sample, and it's tapered and graduated all the way down. At the bottom, the last milliliter is also tapered again. So you can actually not only see 1% accuracy very easily towards the bottoms of these cones, the last 10% is very easy to see 1% accuracy, but the last 1%, it's very easy to read 0.1% accuracy. And it gives you a really good idea of sedimentation. So the first place I would use an Imhoff cone is I can pull a sample of the boil, pre-boil, and I can see exactly what settled out. What didn't I get in my catch in my mash screens? Gives me an idea of how good I'm doing transferring out of my mash. The next place is after whirlpool. I can pull a sample. I can drop it in the Imhoff cone, and I can see how my kettle findings worked. Do I have a nice compact chunk of protein at the bottom? I can do it before whirlpool. I can do it after whirlpool and compare the two. For whatever reason, all stands have 3. I always need 2. I don't know why that is. My desk is really small, so my Imhoff cones take up a fair amount of real estate. I'd rather find a rack with 2. Anytime you're trying to settle a particle, a very interesting fluid engineer named Stokes gave us some interesting equations. The one that I use, and I don't ever actually plug in the numbers, the one I use is Stokes' law, which is settling velocity. And see if I can see this from here. So settling velocity, the faster the velocity, the less aging time we've got. So we want to increase our velocity whenever we can. How we do that, we can't change the acceleration of gravity without a centrifuge. So Stokes' law still works inside of centrifuges. We've just changed the acceleration of gravity. The mass density of the particles, well, we can't change them directly. What we can do is stick heavier objects to them. That is how silica-based findings work. And the other thing we can do is we can stick them together and make them larger. That's kind of why I printed this equation. The radius squared, that means if I double the size of the particle, it settles 4 times as fast. So even the minimal thing you can do to stick yeast particles together, to coagulate protein and polyphenols into long chains, will settle them out much more quickly. And that tends to be the strategy that I take. I personally like isinglass the best of any finding. I no longer use it. I live in California, and people don't really like the idea out there of having fish bladder in their beer. Got the question enough that I finally one day switched to Lucolite TR for hop hazes and Biofine Clear for yeast hazes. The good thing about those, they're non-organic, so nobody says, is this kosher? Neither of them are Rheinheitsgebot approved, so if you're from Germany, you're out of luck on those. The most important thing about this for me has been using the Imhoff cones to see, A, how much is it settling, and B, how tight it is at the bottom. If I'm losing 10 gallons of beer at the bottom of a tank because I have a fluffy sedimentation at the bottom, that's not helping me. I need a tight, compact sedimentation so that when I go and rack out of that tank, I can utilize as much of the beer as possible. If I save 1% of every tank and brew 120 beers, that's a day and a half I get to spend at home with my kids. So it turns out I save a lot more than that. I think in 11 years of being the brewmaster, I'm running about 9% more efficiency out of every tank. So that's half of my vacation a year. I get 15 days of vacation every year. That's about half of my vacation I've paid for just by learning how to fine. Makes my boss happy, and keeps us in production. the next thing we've got to do once our beer is clarified, and I prefer to do it after the beer is clarified. You can carbonate before the beer is clarified. There's some Brownian motion issues with carbonation that can slow your findings down. But unless minutes and hours are your measurement time, you don't have to worry about it. Everybody's seen the CO2 pressure chart. Everybody should have one somewhere. What it tells you is something that's very important. If your beer is flat, it's because it's either at the wrong temperature or the wrong pressure for the carbonation level you want. There are no other answers. And everybody's trying to go, oh, my beer's flat. Well, what's the temperature? What's the carbonation? There is only temperature and carbonation and pressure. In big tanks, we have an issue of it doesn't come to equilibrium very quickly. So if I start forcing CO2 from the top and leave the beer perfectly still, it takes a long time for that carbonation to drift down to the bottom. And I can get issues where the top of the tank is overcarbonated and the bottom of the tank is undercarbonated by using head pressure. So I use force pressure for CO2. I like my beautiful picture of CO2 there. It took me hours to put that together. I can force CO2 over the top. My aging tanks will survive 30 PSI. So I put 28 PSI onto the top of the tank. If I have the proper amount of surface area, the top of my tank is a dome. If I haven't filled up into that dome, I know in exactly 4 days I'll be at the right carbonation level. Now, that just happens to be a trial and error number that works on my tanks. It's not going to work on your tanks. But if I overfill, then I have to start measuring daily. I know it won't be ready at 4 days. I know eventually it will be ready, and I have to keep measuring daily. At my brewery, I don't own a Zomnagel. So for me, measuring CO2 levels means take a draft line, hook it up to the tank, run it out to the bar, pour a pint, see if I like it. Not very scientific, but after lots of time, it can work. The way around that is to put a stone at the bottom of the tank. Anything that's settled out in the tank will get shaken back up in. For findings like isinglass or gelatin, they drop right back out. You don't have to worry about them. Your findings are still really active, and if you have to do something to shake up a tank, like move a keg or something like that, it's going to settle back out. For the biofine clear, it's not as simple as that. It is less active every time it falls. So I can settle a tank. My aging tanks are about this deep. Can settle a tank clear in 4 hours. I have to resettle it, it takes about 12 hours. If I have to resettle it again, it takes about 2 days. If I have to resettle it again, it takes the original 2 weeks that it would have taken without any findings. So for homebrewers, BioFine is probably not the right product unless you're using it in a situation of a bright tank and you're racking out of it. Wanted to bring that up and make it clear because a lot of homebrewers took one of my radio shows and said, oh, I'm going to try to do BioFine. They made a whole bunch of homebrew shops start carrying it. And it's like, well, that is what I use, but I don't use it in your world. And I talked to some of the cask conditioning experts about it. And they said, no, they cannot cask condition with it because once it gets shaken up, it loses its activity. Another method of carbonation, which you don't see in the homebrewing world yet, you see at my level, you certainly see at big breweries. So it's absolutely phenomenal way of carbonation, and it's called pinpoint carbonation. Right at the exit of the filter or the centrifuge or whatever other device you might be using to clarify the beer in line, you inject a pinpoint of carbon dioxide into a part of a pipe that's been squished flat. And what that does is it increases the velocity of flow in that section and changes the pressure there. So if you know the temperature going in, you know the pressure you're putting it at, and you know the change in velocity, you can calculate the carbonation level. And it comes out pretty accurate to what you measure. Once you've done it a few times, you set the gauges the same every day, and every day you get the exact same carbonation. I know a lot of people who pinpoint carbonate straight to a bright tank, leave it in the bright tank for a few minutes, and then start bottling. It can be that accurate with no transfer adjustments. Now, it's really hard to come up with pictures for aging beer, so that was the best one I could come up with. I just saw her photo on the internet, and I just kind of liked her. The benefits of aging beer are head retention, which is protein coagulation, clarification, merging of the flavors. One of those flavors that can, the problems that can happen in there, is that the hops will mellow. That's either a good thing or a bad thing. And my stouts, it's absolutely gorgeous to age some of those hop characters down for about 6 weeks and have them round out into something that's nice. For my IPA, it would ruin it. And so you have to decide if that long aging time is benefiting your hop character or not. The dark side of aging is the hop fading. Staling. Staling is the most important issue when you try to sell your beer that you're ever going to run into. There is nothing worse than walking into a grocery store and going, oh, Lagunitas IPA, I love that beer, and not realizing that you're 3,000 miles from the brewery. You have no idea how that bottle of beer got there. You crack it open and it doesn't taste anything like it does in the brewery. It tastes like drinking beer out of a wet paper bag on a park bench. Because one of the, we'll call staling molecules a black box of molecules. One of those molecules smells just like wet cardboard or wet paper. This is a flavor descriptor. And it's really awful. Fortunately, big breweries like Lagunitas have done a really good job at figuring out what to take out, how to keep oxygen from entering in at every stage of the process. I don't have a lot of access to the Lagunitas brewery, but I have full access to the Sierra Nevada brewery. They do more about removing oxygen than any brewery I've ever been in. And it is absolutely phenomenal, every step that they will take. The other big issue we've got during aging is biological contamination. Even a few cells can become a big issue in a really long time. If you keep your beer cold, they're not going to be very active, very ambitious. But as you let your beer get warm, you're going to see them become more active. You're going to see them try to find sugars that your yeast couldn't eat. And I tend to make my beers very dry. And the reason why I do that, an old brewer, Brian Hunt, who owns Moonlight Brewing, when he was at Stroh's Brewing, the old brewers there taught him that leaving extra starches and extra sugars in the beer is like leaving crumbs on your counter. You might not get ants the first day, but eventually you're going to get ants. And so I try to reduce the starches as much as possible, try not to leave a lot of unfermentables around. It's just a little bit of an insurance policy. Now, there's styles of beer where that's not possible at all. There's styles of beer where if you were to dry it out as much as I dry out an IPA, that style of beer you're going to lose. You're not going to it's not going to taste like that beer anymore. And you're stuck at keeping those beers extra clean. Yeah, and it's good to know which beers those are. Barrel aging. Jay was very nice to loan me this picture. This is Vinny on his birthday. This is how brewers spend their birthdays. Behind him is Terrence Sullivan. Terrence was a bigwig in the brewing department at Sierra Nevada forever. Decided that he wanted to do more in sales. So now he's the liaison between the sales department and the brewing department. He picks out their seasonals, makes sure that everybody's trained, but he also runs the entire program for the brew school they do out there, the beer camp. And that's his whole project. And one of the greatest, most friendly people you'll ever meet in your entire life. And there is not a question that he can't or won't answer. So if you ever get a chance to sit down with him and have dinner, I promise you it'll be the most educational experience of your entire life. Barrel aging is something I don't do at the brewery. So I'm going to talk about what I've learned from the winemakers. My bar is full of regular customers that are winemakers. In Napa County, there are 5 brewing licenses right now, and there are 350 winery licenses. So everybody and their mother is a winemaker, and not a lot of brewers. So when they're off work, they hang out, they drink our beer, and we get a chance to talk to them about barrel aging. I've gotten to speak a little bit with Vinny and with Sierra about their barrel aging programs. We think of barrel aging as a way of adding wood character. Well, if that's what you want to do, I highly suggest you use oak cubes. I think they're far superior to a barrel if all you want is the wood character. Another thing we get out of the barrels, and I think this is what Vinny does phenomenally, is get the other soaked flavors out. His Cabernet that comes through in Consecration is phenomenal. The Pinot that comes through in the Pinot beer, I can't think of which one it is absolutely phenomenal. He does a great job at taking those barrels, tasting each one, coming up with a blend, blending for every batch, and making sure that that soaked barrel flavor comes through. I've done some whiskey barrel-aged beers. Those flavors are more obvious as to what's going to come out. You can smell the barrel, and that'll come through. Another scary thing, though, about barrel aging is you're micro-oxygenating the beer. There's almost nothing you can do about that when you're in a barrel. There are some strategies that I've heard people use. I'm going to give them as ideas, not as proven technology. One of the ways of avoiding micro-oxygenation in a barrel is to keep the outside of your barrels wet. It's very important to do it with non-chlorinated water. If there's any chlorine that touches the outside of your barrel, it will certainly contaminate the beer with TCAs. I've tried this in a number of 10-gallon barrels. I find it works better. Now, the other side of that coin is one of the reasons why big beers like Consecration work so well is micro-oxygenation is actually benefiting Vinny in this case. It's producing an off flavor in beer that we call sherry. And if you keep it down to low levels, it's that sherry-like character adds depth and body. So a little bit of oxygen is good. The oldest Consecration I've had was 8 years old. Had an 8-year-old keg of Consecration on tap at the brewery, at our brewery, and absolutely phenomenal after 8 years. So aged very, very well. And I'm sure Vinny was glad to get that empty keg back. Took it out of circulation for a long time for him. Bottle conditioning, I think, is, you know, a lot of home brewers are trying to shy away from it and go to that nifty little device. I designed that for More Beer many, many years ago, 14 years ago. And a lot of people have switched to that, or I see the Blickman beer gun, a little bit more convenient to operate, I think, than this one. Both do interesting things. I like counter pressure bottle filling for storing bottles for the short term. I like to get them to a competition where they're going to be judged quickly. You know they're going to stay cold. We cannot keep enough oxygen out of a counter pressure bottle filler to make it useful for long term aging of beer. A commercial brewery can do it, but they're also are injecting gases onto the top. My favorite is liquid nitrogen on the top, right before capping. That does a really good job of purging the headspace. Bottle conditioning, I think, is your best answer. There's a really good reason for that. That yeast is going to take any oxygen in that headspace and consume it before it starts fermenting your bottling sugars. The very, very important task that happens in bottle conditioning. If you look at a bottle of Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, there's a way of cutting one open. I don't know if you've ever cut a bottle open, but you take a string, soak it in kerosene, tie it around the bottle, set the string on fire, break it on the score line. It will break open perfectly cleanly, and you can examine the bottom of the bottle. There is a perfectly fine layer, about a paper-thick layer of yeast on the bottom of every bottle of Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, because Ken thinks it's so important to keep oxygen out of the beer, and he thinks it's the only way, even with his multi-million-dollar bottling lines, that he can do that. It is the smallest amount of yeast you've ever heard of. I've talked to the brewers about it. They actually take all the yeast out at the end of fermentation, put it into a bright tank, and redose the yeast back in so they can control exactly how much yeast is in every bottle of Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. Phenomenal process. It's amazing that he can keep that running at the level that he did. I think last year he maxed out the Chico Brewery at 1.2 million barrels a year. That's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week brewing. The new brewery looks like it's going to max out its current capacity at over 400,000 barrels this year. So we're seeing somebody take bottle conditioning to a whole new level. Watching what Sierra does, reading the papers that Sierra comes out about it, I think is going to be really beneficial to all of us. Thank you very much for listening to a rambling path through the brew house at Thinking About Aging. I skipped some stuff, and I would really encourage some questions. Anybody have any questions? Yeah. I don't anymore. I did for a very long time. I use 001 now. Yeah, personally, I find that the 002 is my absolute favorite strain of yeast that we've ever found. I would make every beer in the world with 002 if I was brewing it for myself. 001 is more predictable. And the reason for that is 002 likes to flocculate out a little early and leave diacetyl behind. When it does that, all you can do is wait. In a production environment, that extra 2 days that I have to wait can mean the difference of me being in trouble with my boss or not. So I switched from 002 to 001 for more consistency in the brew house. I was keeping 001 in the brew house to do my double IPA because 002 leaves too much residual sugars for a double IPA to taste dry enough for me. So I had it in the brew house. I'd been doing experiments with it. The switch was pretty natural. I had about 300 batches of experience on the 002. I now have close to 350 batches on the 001. For a production environment, it's God's gift to man. It leaves just enough esters behind. It's relatively temperature tolerant. It doesn't flocculate out too early. And when you want it to flocculate out, it goes away. Yeah. Beer gas, bev gas, yeah. So there's a whole branch of chemistry called partial pressures. And if you look in any high school chemistry textbook, read the chapter on partial pressures. It'll give you an idea of what's going on. There's two things going on with bev gas. One is nitrogen's barely soluble in beer. I think 1% or 2% was the number I was given 15 years ago when I was studying all that stuff. The CO2 is nearly all the way soluble in beer. So what you're doing is you're blending the two gases so that all the CO2 can't go into solution, and it gives you a lower CO2 level. Then what you do during dispense is you pass it through a disc that's got a bunch of little holes in it. You strip the CO2 that you did get put into it out so that you see that beautiful cascade. When what you're done with is this beautiful head on what is basically a perfectly still glass of beer, very, very low carbonation levels, a little bit higher than post-fermentation, but not a lot higher than post-carbonation or post-fermentation once it's in the glass and all the bubbles have settled out. Yeah. You know, that's one I haven't noticed, but I will look for it, and I'll ask Charlie about it the next time I bump into him. Well, and metallic is an odd flavor. Normally when I get it, the metallic flavor I hate the most is the one that tastes like blood. It tastes like sucking on a mosquito bite when you're a little kid. That's the one I dislike the most. That usually comes from iron pickup and usually in the hot liquor. Usually somebody has a contaminated well jacket and they're transferring water into their hot liquor tank, and that's continuing all the way through to the finished beer. Iron in the finished beer is just absolutely terrible at staling. If any metallic flavors are probably going to tell you that the shelf life is going to be awful as well. As far as what could come from the gases, I would look more at the tanks than the gases for a problem. Yeah, anybody? Stand up and talk. Seven barrel Grundy's. So the aging side of my brew house, everything gets brewed at a seven barrel batch size. Everything gets transferred into a seven barrel Grundy. So there are no changes in volume at any point in my brewing process. Then I pour straight from the Grundy to the faucet. Yeah. Oh, sure. He was asking what vessels I use to age beer in. I use the bright tanks themselves as aging tanks. I have 18 7-barrel Grundys and 9 beers on tap. Gives me a lot of room to age. Oh, yeah, thank you for bringing me back to that. I kind of skipped over it in the slide, and I meant to talk about it. Charlie Bamforth is head of brewing science at UC Davis. He believes that hot side aeration is the biggest load of hoo-ha that has ever been perpetuated upon a generation of brewers. He's been fighting against it for at least a decade. I get to talk to him about it all the time. What I can tell you about that is everything he says makes a lot of sense. It is one paper that really brought this all into the brewing world. The other thing I can say is Anheuser-Busch Fairfield's right next to me. Most of their brew staff came out of Charlie Bamforth's program, and before him, Dr. Lewis's program. They do everything they can to eliminate hot side aeration, even if it involves millions of dollars of equipment upgrade. And Sierra Nevada also does everything it can, and most of its brewers came out of Charlie Bamforth's program. So Charlie believes it, publishes about it, is very fervent about it. The breweries that are in operation don't seem to agree with him. Because my beer never gets warm, I'm not really picky about hot side aeration, but I don't go out of my way to add any either. If my beers were out there getting warm, the first purchase I'd buy is a wet mill. And I'd get all that air out of those husks before it got hot. Wet milling is probably the number one cause, or dry milling is probably the number one cause of hot side aeration in the brewery. When brewing lager beers, are the things that I do different? I do try to be a lot more careful about my yeast pitching rates. And I try to be a lot more careful about my oxygenation rates. And I'll give you, this is something I've been trying lately. I will offer it up as an idea. I've offered it up before. Instead of oxygenating your wort, because it's so hard for you guys to measure oxygen, don't bother. You're already making a starter. So that morning, right when you mash in, go ahead and warm up some DME on the stove, make something that's about 1040, feed your starter that morning, and spin it with an aeration stone in there with an aquarium pump and a sterile filter. Aerate it for exactly 4 hours. Take that whole thing and push it in to the beer, and do not aerate your wort at all. The reason for that is you know you're not adding any extra oxygen at that point, so you can't over-oxygenate. Pure oxygen is really easy to over-oxygenate with. Makes terrible off flavors. Not as bad as under-oxygenating. But the reason why you're adding oxygen is to build the sterol reserves in the yeast. And 4 hours in a oxygen-flushed environment is enough to get the sterols at 100%. When we do this test in labs, Chris Bolton, when he did this test in labs, found that he was getting 100% vitality in 4 hours. All that research was done at Coors of England. And phenomenal research papers. Don't see it in process at any brewery yet. If I had a big enough stir plate to stir my pitch of yeast, I'd be doing it every day. Great way to deal with lagers too. You know, I think your vessels are so short that the difference in time, for me, my vessels are taller, so the difference in time between gelatin and isinglass is pretty major. I can also buy better quality isinglass than I can buy gelatin. So I like isinglass. It's difficult to work with. Gelatin's really easy to work with. If I was a home brewer, I'd probably take the lazy way out and use gelatin. If you want to learn a lot about fining chemistry and have a pH meter, isinglass is really fun to play with. It is phenomenally fast. I would put the finings in a tank. I would force carbonate from the bottom of the tank with a stone for an hour and 45 minutes, pull the stone off, and an hour later the beer would be perfectly bright. And that's 4.5 feet of settling. phenomenal amount of settling. Can't do that without Isinglass. What, you know, and this is where we have to open the black box of proteins. What I think WorldFlock does, the carrageenan, what's the name of the seaweed? The Irish moss, thank you. What the Irish moss does, I think, is more important in that I get a tighter compacted, when I look at my own Imhoff cones, I get a tighter compact of troub at the bottom of my cone. So I get to extract more beer. I actually think it gives me 2 days off a year to add it, and it's a very minimal cost. In homebrewing, I don't know if the volume increase transferred over is enough for you to notice. That 2 ounces of beer, 3 ounces of beer you save might not be enough for it to be worth the effort. But an Imhoff cone would teach you. Actually, no, I'm sorry. I only have one. That is the best thing I know. So air, not all air is going through the gaps and the slats, but some of it is. Keeping the outside of the barrels wet keeps the gaps and the slats closed longer, the gaps and the staves closed for a longer distance. That's all it's doing for you, is swelling the barrel. Other than that, the air can still go straight through the wood. In the big tanks, the big wineries now in Napa, what you're seeing are these tanks that are 200, anywhere from 200 to 2,000 barrels, wine barrels of wine, and they're dropping staves into them, and they're doing micro-ox from the bottom, and it's all done on computer control, so they can control the micro-ox very specifically. And that's how they're mimicking the romantic barrel-aged wines without having to go through big blending programs. So one day that might become... I've done some micro-ox in my double IPA. I kind of like it. So there are some reasons to add a little bit of oxygen if you know the beer's never going to leave the building or you're going to consume it nearly immediately. Okay, one last question. No, I would probably do it one step earlier. So back when I was homebrewing, the idea was you fermented in one vessel, you transferred into another vessel for what we called a secondary fermentation. Well, there was no real fermentation going on. There was no sugar left. We weren't transferring it when it was active. So what is the issue? And really it was just getting a chance to separate some of that yeast out and some of the proteins out before you transfer it into your bottles. I think that's a good idea, and that's where I would add the gelatin. It's very important to do that at your serving temperature because you will make a chill haze if you try to find above serving temperature. One other thing I can talk about is dry hopping is great at adding reductones. Dry hopping also adds a lot of oxygen. Probably should have put a slide in there so I remember to say something about it. The way Sierra Nevada gets around it, the way Mike McDowell, Tasty McDowell's been getting around it, he learned it up at Sierra. They're adding dry hops with 2% sugar still left. So that's when they believe they're 0.0008 above their final gravity, they do their dry hopping at that moment. The reason for that is the oxygen's still active enough to consume, the yeast is still active enough to consume that oxygen. They feel they're getting less oxygen in the finished product and a longer shelf life. So that's something else you can think about when you're dry hopping. For me, the yeast settles on top of my hops so well and shields my hops from the beer that I can't do that method. I have tried it where I've fined first, transferred, dry hopped, transferred, but it's a lot of extra cleaning and sanitizing for me. Okay, well, I think I'm going to wrap it up. My throat is getting a little dry here. thank you very, very much.
So on behalf of the AHA, we'd like to thank Colin Kaminsky for coming out and doing this talk. So one more big hand for Colin. Come on. Hey, here you go. This is a gift from the AHA. You're welcome. And thank you.